Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll-free 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to this Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live. Today, open forum Q&A on church history. If you have questions about church history, please give us a call, 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Before we start, I want to take a minute to thank everyone who reached out and supported us over the last 3 days of our pledge drive. We are very, very blessed to have so many people who are willing to partner with us to keep this show on the air. And I hope we will find other ways to express our gratitude in the coming days. And again, today, we welcome any question you might have on the history of the Catholic Church, whether you want to know about the Crusades or the Inquisitions or anything else in the whole entire history of the Church. Again, the number, 888-318-7884 or 888-31-TRUTH. Our guest this hour is Steve Weidenkopf, a lecturer of church history at the Graduate School of Christendom College, and the creator and author of EPIC, A Journey Through Church History, an Adult Faith Formation Program on the 2,000-Year History of the Church. His book, The Glory of the Crusades, is published by Catholic Answers Press. And, Steve Weidenkopf, thank you very much for being here with us.
Thank you, Simon. I'm glad to be here.
And we've kept you busy all day here because you've recorded some stuff for us. And
yes.
We even just finished recording something just before we went on the air. So
exactly. It's been a busy day, but a fun day.
Okay, yes. Good. I'm glad it was fun for you. And you've enjoyed San Diego. You haven't been here before.
I have. No, this is my first time to San Diego. So, yeah, I enjoy it actually a lot. Yeah, it's nice. The weather's been nice, I guess, today. But, yeah, love it.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Okay, good. We got good grades
yes.
for our
university.
Now, you have the website is ourcatholichistory.com.
Correct.
Is that right? And
yes,
tell us a little bit about what happens there.
Yeah, so on ourcatholichistory.com, you can investigate my EPIC program. So there's two different studies, actually. There's the EPIC, A Journey Through Church History program, which is the basic study, which is a 20-session study that covers the entire 2,000-year history of the church. And then there's also a section on the other study, which is the follow-up study, which is on the early church, which is called EPIC, The Early Church. And that covers the first 500 years. That's a 10-session study as well. And so there's video clips on there on different topics that you can review. There's information on the program, how to bring it to your parish, how to use it with others in your home if you want. So it's very comprehensive and set up there for everyone who wants to look at it.
Yeah, it's really cool how the tools now, the interactive and the various graphics can actually make stuff. Like for someone like me, often I need to see it or I need to put it in the context with something else on a timeline or something, right. Then I get it. And this stuff just does that beautifully.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, that's the whole point is to try to take church history and divide it into time periods, which have colors associated with them so people can remember the main event of what's going on in those time periods. Because there's a lot to church history, right? I mean, it's 2,000 years worth of popes and saints and events and all kinds of things going on. So how do we keep track of all this and sense of all that? And how do we get it into digestible chunks? And that's what I hope to get at with EPIC and the early church.
And out of that whole 2,000-year history of the church, where's the area that you are most interested in? Like from this date to this date, where's
yeah, your... for me, the time period that I'm most interested in and most focused on is the medieval period. So you're looking at about the year 1,000 to 1,300, a little more into the 1,400s maybe. That for me is the most interesting time. I mean, one historian, Warren Carroll, who founded Christendom College, referred to it as the glory of Christendom, right? It's the time of great events, right? Things are just – there's amazing things. There's the great architecture, for example. It's Gothic architecture and whole villages for a century are focused on building these great magnificent temples to God. It's a time period of great pilgrimage, for example, with the Crusades. There's all kinds of fantastic saints that are living during this period of time as well. And there's some bad times too. And so it's always good to know about those and to find out what was going on in church history those times as well.
What about this kind of attitude about the – I mean, we even call it the Middle Ages, like it's between the important stuff. It's not the important stuff itself.
Right.
A person like you, okay, so what do you think when people say, well, it was just a bunch of mud, like nothing happened in that time. What do you say?
Yeah, there's a French medievalist named Régine Pernod who wrote a book called Those Terrible Middle Ages, right, as if they're this horrible time in history that people kind of associate with them. I would say to them that, if you really study the history of that period of time, you see that the people people who lived, especially in Western Europe at the time, were people who were great innovators, mm-hmm. right? We mentioned the cathedrals. I mean, just the ability to build those kinds of structures without the type of technology and modern equipment that we have is truly miraculous, really. It's amazing what they did. They had a great love for mathematics, you know, for geometry as well. I mean, these were people that were very intellectual. The only difference really between us and them is time and technology, right, and the advancement of technology. And they were very faithful people for the most part. Again, not everybody living then was a saint, obviously, but, you know, they were – the church and the faith kind of permeated all of society, and that was their focal point of their lives as well.
And in many ways, they could think better than us. I mean, when you think about, like, say, modern philosophy as compared to medieval philosophy, it just doesn't – there's no comparison in the quality of the thinking.
Right. Well, that's – you know, primarily because medieval philosophy is rooted in reality, right? It's rooted in trying to explain, you know, the world, right? I mean, rooted in Aristotelian philosophy and trying to understand how the world is and what we can know about God from the world and things like that. Whereas modern philosophy is divorced from that, right? Divorced from reality. It's really the construct of our mind and answering silly questions like why is the sky blue and is the sky blue and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is.
Is it blue?
It is. Yes. Right. I live here in San Diego. It's blue almost all the time. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. And our topic this hour is really any question that you've got on the entire history of the Catholic Church. So we are calling it an open forum Q&A on church history. Shall we take a question before we take the first break?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Gina in Rochester, New York, you are on with Steve Weidenkopf. What is your question about the history of the church?
Hi, good afternoon, gentlemen. The Bible and how it came together has always been kind of perplexing for me, and I would like to know how the Bible books were collected. If there was a, I know the Catholic Church painstakingly took care of that, and the time frame that it took to collect them, and then when was it officially like the Bible? Like what year did that happen and how?
Yeah, so a fantastic question. So, you know, in terms of the development of the canon of Scripture, I mean, it really wasn't until you get to the 4th century where the church decided, you know, to come up with the list of canon. Now, previous to that, even in the 2nd century, we have documents like the Muratorian Fragment that list the different books of the Bible, which eventually would be considered canonical by the church. So really what the kind of the definitive or defining moment, to answer your direct question, happened in two local councils in the 4th century, the Council of Hippo and the Council of Carthage. And so by the year 397, the church has its official canonized list of books, which comprise the Old Testament and the New Testament. And the Old Testament was, you know, the early church used the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Hebrew Bible. And so that had been pretty consistent for years. And so the question was really, what do we include in the canon of the New Testament? And that's when the church decided to do it. And that was then adopted and you know, carried on through the church's history through the centuries until you get to the 16th century in Trent, where the Council of Trent actually then you know, solidifies that list, or reaffirms, I should say, the list of the canon of scriptures of at that time as well.
Gina, how does that strike you?
Does the Vatican have the writings?
Does the Vatican have the writings in terms of
well, because
manuscripts?
You keep referring to a list.
Oh,
no,
yeah.
I didn't.
Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah. So, yes. So there's a Muratorian Fragment. I'm not certain if that's in the Vatican Library or where that document is, frankly, but there was a list by St. Athanasius. And, yeah, there's documents, you know, in the archives, you know, for going back to centuries that show us that's a list that comprised the canon of Scripture.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Gina, we will take a quick break and we'll be right back with more church history, your questions on church history for Professor Steven Weidenkopf when we come right back.
Hi, this is Bishop James Wall from the Diocese of Gallup, New Mexico. Keep it right here on Catholic Answers Live.
Martin Luther and John Calvin, considered by many to be the fathers of the Protestant Reformation. But was it a reformation or a revolution? It's time you heard the real story. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf says that much of what we know about this crucial period in the history of the Church is seen through a Protestant lens, and that the men credited with reform of the church actually started a revolution that sought to destroy it. History comes alive as Professor Weidenkopf takes an in-depth look at the period in history when this major change in the church took place, and equally important, the men who sought to change it. Learn the real story. Get your copy of The Real Story of the Reformation today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Also available as an MP3.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. John 6:52 describes how the Jews quarreled among themselves, saying, "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" Jesus replied, "Unless you eat the flesh of the Son of Man and drink his blood, you do not have life in you. Whoever eats my flesh and drinks my blood has eternal life, and I will raise him up on the last day. For my flesh is real food, and my blood is real drink." If his listeners were mistakenly taking him too literally, he could easily have clarified the matter for them. He was not talking cannibalism here, though some have thought so. He was speaking sublime mystery. He was speaking of the living sign of his passion that the Eucharist was to be. The appearance of bread and wine on the altar tells the story. That his body gave of its blood to the death remains the memorial of his infinite love for us that we celebrate at Mass. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
What do you want to know about church history? We've got the guy who can answer your questions. Steve Weidenkopf is here with us. Any question you've got on the history of the 2,000 years of history, you must just really have it packed in there.
That's a lot of history to remember.
That is a lot of history to remember. Another man who knows a great deal about Catholic history is here with us. Chris Check, our president at Catholic Answers. Hi, Chris.
Gentlemen, I especially want to welcome Steve to our studio here in San Diego.
Yeah, thank you.
Are you going to have time to get on a surfboard while you're here?
I'm not. No, I have to take the red eye back home. I'm going to miss all that, unfortunately.
Well, then you'll need to plan to come a day early or stay a day late when you come to speak at our conference in September, and we'll get you on a surfboard.
That'll be great.
Okay. We'll get Tim Ryland, the editor of the magazine. He's a surfer.
Okay.
Yeah. He can teach
you.
Yeah, but that's what I want to talk about here. Our conference is approaching end of September, September 28 to 30. The theme, of course, is the reunion of all Christians. Why? Because, 500 years ago, Martin Luther caused this rupture in the mystical body of Christ, which has just... what's the word I'm looking
metastasized
for?
Metastasized.
Thank you. Thank you. I did the hand gesture and you got it. Metastasized.
Okay.
And we're thrilled that Steve is going to be on the program. Steve, what are you going to be talking about?
So I'm going to be giving a talk on Luther and Calvin. So some of the first early revolutionaries and whether or not they were revolutionaries. Were they reformers or were they revolutionaries? And so I'm going to kind of walk us through that and talk about that particular point.
Probably two men that a lot of people think they know something about, but really don't know very much about.
Yes, that's very
and
true.
They might be a little bit alarmed to learn a few things about them.
Yes. Very few people have read actually what they wrote.
Some of it's quite alarming.
Yes, some of it is quite eye-opening. Yes, yeah. And alarming. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, folks, to hear Steve's talk, and also Devin Rose, author of Crossing the Tiber, is going to be there giving a talk about how to help your separated brethren. Across the Tiber, and editor of Ignatius Press, Mark Brumley, is going to be talking about things not to do in trying to bring Protestants into the Catholic Church. And then, of course, the usual suspects, Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Carlo Broussard, the reunion, the unification of all Christians, and Cy, what I think is the highlight.
Okay. All right.
I'm really? Serious. So this is our fourth conference, I think. Yeah. What I think is the highlight is when we do the live broadcast of Catholic Answers Live there in front of 800, 1,000 people, we hope, this year. And we just take questions from the studio audience, and the energy's in
it's
the room.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah, it's a blast.
I've listened to it 1 year on the radio. I was in the room, I think, 1 or 2 years, I don't know, and it is so high energy. It's just great. It's wonderful.
And I'm also very happy to be handing off the Master of Ceremonies responsibilities to Cy Kellett.
This just happened.
That was a smooth transition.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he does it on the air, so I can't say no.
Well, maybe we can tag team it. We'll see. Yeah. Very good. Okay, my friends, special early bird pricing through July 2nd, which is not very far away. Get your tickets soon. Seats are going fast, and they are limited. There's only so many human persons we can fit inside that space. We have a new hotel this year the Aventine, the Hyatt Aventine in La Jolla. They have given us, it's a nicer hotel than the Sheraton we used last year, which was lovely, but this one's even nicer. And they have given us a cheaper room rate, and the parking is much less expensive. I'm just going to come out and say, those of you who are there, that parking is expensive down at the Sheraton. We have a vastly better deal for parking at the Aventine. So, and the registration is cheaper than last year. So there's every reason to come.
Yeah.
How do I find out about the conference?
You go to CatholicAnswersConference.com. It's just that easy. Just go online to CatholicAnswersConference.com and you get all the information you want. July 2nd is the key day to keep in mind, though, because everything before July 2nd falls under that special early bird pricing that Chris was mentioning.
Tim Staples, Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, Carlo Broussard, Devin Rose, Mark Brumley, and our special in-studio guest, Steve Weidenkopf, a live broadcast of Catholic Answers. And here's the last thing. These conferences, the great thing about them are the people who come. And there's that conviviality in the hallway between the talks and at the banquet and at the receptions. And folks, you're going to have a great time and you're going to learn a lot. CatholicAnswersConference.com.
And September in San Diego. I was telling Steve about it earlier.
That is the time to come.
I've never seen something like September in San Diego.
Because the beaches have emptied out and the water is still warm. The tourists
beautiful.
Have gone home. It's the time to come to San Diego. Absolutely. All right. God bless you, gentlemen. Steve, again, welcome to San Diego. Welcome to Catholic Answers.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. CatholicAnswersConference.com is the place to go. Open forum on church history today. Happy to take any call, any question you've got on the history of the church. Steve Weidenkopf, our guest. And Steve, we go to Bow in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Bow, you are on with Steve Weidenkopf. What's your question?
Yes. Thank you so much. Thanks for letting me be in this phone. I was looking over the history of the Catholic Church pre and post Vatican II. So what was the Catholic Church like pre and post Vatican II?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And did Vatican II bring big changes to our daily Catholic life? Because I don't know how Catholics lived
before. Okay, Bao, excellent question.
Yeah, Bao, that is a fantastic question. And I'm going to answer it. I'll kind of answer it in an indirect way first in terms of understanding that, you know, the obviously the teachings of the church have not changed, right? So there's continuity in what the church has believed from the time of you know, Jesus through the apostles, through the early church, all the way up into, you know, Vatican II in the 1960s. So no change in teaching in terms of, but the faith is lived, right? And the faith has to be expressed in the centuries in which the faithful Catholics live. And so there's going to be certain things we call disciplines, right? Doctrines never change, but disciplines can in the church. And so, you know, in previous centuries, you know, there might be a greater devotion to a particular saint than another. There may be, you know, a particular form of architecture or something than in one time period as opposed to the other. So, you know, pre-Vatican II, I mean, one of the biggest changes, for example, was the liturgy, right? One of the documents of the Second Vatican Council called Sacrosanctum Concilium, or the Constitution on the Sacred Liturgy, called for a renewal of the liturgy. And so one of the things that flew out of or came out of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council was Paul VI promulgating the Novus Ordo Mass. And so that's the kind of the Mass that now it's called the ordinary form. And that's the Mass that most people are familiar with when you go to Mass on Sundays and other days. So that was a difference, right? That was a change in terms of the liturgy. But again, what happens to the liturgy is the same from apostolic times to today. It's just the kind of the format, if you will, or even structure of it can change. So those things kind of change from, you know, pre-Vatican II to post-Vatican II. Another example of what changed in Catholic life is lay participation. Right, you have a lot more participation of the laity in terms of Catholic Answers is a great example of that. Right, in terms of laity getting together and of defending the faith, of helping to spread the faith throughout the world, greater participation and focus on the laity doing that post Vatican II than pre Vatican II. Those are just some examples.
Thank you very much, Bao, for that question. See if I can just follow Bao's question a little bit with my own now that I have you here. Mm-hmm. Many people might look and say, why did they even have a council when you say the church seemed to be so, like the churches were full and there were lots of priests and sisters and mm-hmm. So why did they have a council?
Yeah, that's a great question. And actually, one of the best resources on that is to go and look at Cardinal Ratzinger, who was a theological expert at the council.
Uh-huh.
And he wrote a book several years after the council called Theological Reflections. And he asks that question and answers that question. You know, why was there a need for a council? Part of the reason was that at the middle part of the 20th century, in the 1960s, you have to keep in mind the historical context. What had just happened was the world had gone through two horrific world wars.
Yeah.
Right? First World War, Second World War. And St. John the 23rd at the time, and then later Paul VI, recognized that the modern world was in need of Christ, right? Was in need,
yes,
of Christ's saving message because of that. Many people had lost their faith because of the horrific nature of the war and what had happened and the death. And it was a time, too, of the flowering of some of these Enlightenment ideas, of secularization, of moral relativism. All these things we're dealing with today, you know, were very prevalent still then. And so the Pope wanted to have this fresh outpouring of the Holy Spirit to first of all, reinvigorate the church so that the church being reformed and renewed within can then go and be that source of light and renewal and reform to the world.
Ah, yeah. Well, let's go now to Kaylin in Crawfordsville, Indiana, listening on 89.1 FM. Kaylin, your question for Steve Weidenkopf.
Hello, gentlemen. So I am very new to looking at the world and through the Catholic lens. My family is very, very, very Protestant and aren't really thrilled with what I've been talking about recently. My question would be, what is something, or maybe a couple of somethings, that you could point to that the Catholic Church has the absolute authority of Christ and is the church that Christ founded in reference to the Reformation and Protestantism? And I hope that question makes sense to you.
Yeah, that's a great question, Kaylin. Prayers out to you in your family situation as well. That's always a difficult situation to be in, and I commend you for your faith and for being willing to talk with and your family and defend the faith as well. So, one thing that I would talk about, at least from a historical perspective, is the best thing to do really is to go back and look at the writings of the early church fathers. Frankly, and in particular, I would look at Pope St. Clement I and his letter to the Corinthians, as well as to St. Ignatius of Antioch. So just to give you a brief overview, historical on that, St. Ignatius of Antioch was martyred in the early part of the second century, very revered member of the church, and he was arrested in Antioch by the Roman emperor. And instead of executing him in Antioch, Trajan ordered him to be sent to Rome so he could be executed in the capital city in a big public kind of event, make an example, so to speak, of Ignatius. And so that required him to be transported from Antioch to Rome. And so during the transport, he had time to write letters. And so he wrote letters to six different Catholic communities, as well as to one individual, St. Polycarp. And when you read through Ignatius's letters, you see a man who's, number one, deep in faith, but number two, thoroughly Catholic. In fact, St. Ignatius was the one who gave the church her name, Catholic. Right? He used that Greek word universal to apply to the church in general. And when you read his writings, you understand this. He comes across very clearly with the understanding of the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist, the hierarchical constitution of the church, meaning that the church is founded on the apostles, with their successors being bishops, priests, deacons. It's all present. Everything that you see in the church is there today, is there present in Ignatius's letters. So I take solace in that, really, right? And we all should, as Catholics, that historical example of the early Christian writers, they were thoroughly Catholic. They only understood the world from a Catholic perspective. There was one church, as there is one church today. So that I think is a big help, to go back and look at those situations of the early church fathers.
Kaylin, does that help you?
It does, very much so, yes. I appreciate it.
Oh, very good. Thank you for that call. And you can, those books, though ancient, like writings of St. Ignatius, you can get them and read them. And I found, not long ago, did an interview on Catholic Answers Focus, Steve, with a pastor, Protestant pastor, who said, I want to know how the early church lived. And he went back and read Ignatius.
Yeah.
And this Easter, he and his congregation came into the Catholic Church.
That's awesome.
So it's very powerful to go back and read those early texts.
It is, absolutely.
Steve Weidenkopf, a professor of church history at the graduate school at Christendom College, is our guest this hour. Any question you have on the history of the Catholic Church, from its very beginnings to its current standing, We're happy to take those questions today. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Dr. Paul Thigpen says, a spiritual war with eternal consequences rages all around us and within us, and no one is exempt from the duty to fight. Marching Orders is a handbook for battle that will help you engage the enemy of your soul with faith and fortitude. Order your copy of Marching Orders today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the online shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Wouldn't it be great to have a book to give to anyone to explain exactly why Catholics believe what we believe? The good news is that now there is! Why We're Catholic is the groundbreaking new resource by apologist Trent Horn. That one book you can hand to anyone as a starting point for helping them find their way into, or back to, the practice of the Catholic faith. In a series of short, easy-to-read chapters, Trent covers the whole range of common topics, starting with why we believe in anything at all, and answering all the common objections to the Catholic faith, both doctrinal and moral. Don't miss out on the most important, life-changing book to come along in years. Better yet, it's only $3 a copy when you order in bulk. Order your copies of Why We're Catholic today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
It's the start of a new day for Morning Catholic Radio.
Monday mornings sometimes make me say, Lord, have mercy, give me the strength. And so let's remember that after every Good Friday is the Easter Sunday. And guess what? After every Monday is going to be another Sunday.
To quote St. Paul from Philippians, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I say rejoice.
Iterum dico vobis.
Morning Glory. Catholic from the start. Weekday mornings, 7 Eastern on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Thank you for joining us for this Friday edition of Catholic Answers Live. Next hour, Professor Peter Kraft from Boston College will be here to talk about his latest book. And we'll be talking a little bit about the Reformation there, because he's got some of that in his upcoming book. It's a pretty good day today. We got two really good professors today. And one of them's you, by the way.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I didn't want you to make that connection. Also, to let you know, from Friday to Monday, that is all over all weekend until next Monday, everything that Steve Weidenkopf has on Catholic.com that we sell is 30% off. And this includes his best-selling book, The Glory – or I should say Glory of the Crusades. It's not The Glory.
That's it? The Glory. Yeah,
oh, the Glory. Yeah. Oh, I said it wrong. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Glory of the Crusades, and then – which I think is – changed a lot of people's minds. I do think because that thing was it was almost as if like it was like a meme, kind of like we've decided, oh, Crusades, like the Christians were the bad guys,
right? Yeah.
And I think the Glory of the Crusades really helps with that. You also, his audio presentations, The Real Story of the Inquisition, Real Story of the Crusades, and Real Story of the Reformation. Just that you didn't know you did that one.
I did.
Yeah, you were like surprised. I'm like, that's not, I didn't do that one. Just visit the shop at shop.catholic.com anytime this weekend and 30% off all of Steve Weidenkopf's materials there. Let's go to Chris in Hastings, Michigan, listening on Holy Family Radio. Chris, you are on with Professor Steve Weidenkopf. Hi, Chris. You there? No? All right, Chris, yeah. We're going to come back to you. Oh, okay. We got to have to come back to you, Chris. I'm sorry about that. We'll go to Michael in Texas, listening on Guadalupe Radio. Michael, you are on with Professor Steve Weidenkopf.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, my question is, I'm making my way into the Catholic Church, so I don't know all of the history. I'm coming from a Jewish background. So if you could bear with me. Sure. My understanding is that the Catholic Church changed a lot of how the service is done, like as far as like even the sign of the way that people make the sign of the cross. It's very different today than the Orthodox Church. That the Orthodox Church has a more original service as far as the liturgy being sung and all those things. And so my question is, I guess, first, why did they change it, and is it okay?
Sure. So, so Michael, thank you for calling and for your question. In terms of changes, I mean, I don't know if you heard the question a little bit earlier in the show, but we talked about how the church is, lives through the centuries, a living church, right? So there are times when obviously the doctrines, teachings, whatnot of the faith do not change and haven't changed. But the way in which we live out this expression, right, the way we express rather our faith through the centuries has developed and changed over time. And of course, one area of that is the liturgy. And so I mentioned earlier about how during the course of as a result of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council, you did have a reform and change of the liturgy. But really, when you and some people see that as like a change, a break from what had come before, and it was a break at least from the reform of the liturgy previous to that, and the reform of the liturgy previous to the Second Vatican Council was the Council of Trent in the 16th century. But if you go back into the early church and you look, especially as we talked about the early church fathers, you look at the writings of Saint Hippolytus, for example. He wrote a work that's titled Apostolic Tradition. And what he gave in Apostolic Tradition was a description of the liturgical and sacramental life of the Church of Rome in the 3rd century. And many of the things that are – many of the structures of the element of the liturgy that Hippolytus writes about in Apostolic Tradition from the Church of Rome in the 3rd century is what was incorporated into the Novus Ordo as a result of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. So there's that continuity there. There was a change, yes, from one liturgy to the next, so to speak, but it was really a change kind of going back to the original time of the early church. So there is that still continuity there. So that's just, again, it's just a lived expression, and, there's many differences between the East and West in terms of liturgy and history and whatnot. But I think that's the kind of major point I'm going to leave you with, is that there's a change, but yes, still always a continuity.
Michael, does that address your question?
Yes, and the name of who is that, the church father, Hippolytus?
St. Hippolytus, and he's a... an early church father, died in the early part of the 3rd century. And actually, just one small note about St. Hippolytus, he's the only anti-pope ever in the history of the church to be reconciled back to the church and declared a saint. So that's a fun little story.
Thank you very much, Michael, for that. That gives us hope for all of us. Like, you can mess up. Like, you could be the anti-pope, right. Come back and be a saint of the church. 888-318-7884 is our number, 888-318-7884. We're talking church history today with Professor of Church History, Steve Weidenkopf. We're happy to take your calls. We go now to Sylvia in California, listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Sylvia, your question for Professor Weidenkopf.
My question was, I know that... historically, I was raised Catholic, and I take communion in the mouth, and then when it changed, we could take it in the hand or by mouth. It was presented to me recently that we were asked to, instead of just leaving it in the hand and picking it up with our fingers, that we would actually put it next to our mouth and then put our tongues on the host and take it in. Is that new according to the church, or is it historically somewhere down there that they did it before?
So that's a question, Sylvia, that, I mean, I'm not a liturgist, first of all, so that's probably more of those kinds of a question for that person. But in terms of, I do know, right, that the church teaches that the faithful can receive, either one of two ways, the host, and either, directly on the tongue or in your hand. And, it is applicable, or it's appropriate to be able to pick up the host with your other hand. One hand forms kind of the throne, so to speak, of the host of Jesus. You take that host and then put it with your other hand, pick it up and pick Jesus up and put him in your mouth that way. So I think that's appropriate. I've never really heard of going hand to mouth, so to speak, directly and keeping the host on the hand. But
I never heard of it.
I've never heard of that. So definitely not something that Hippolytus maybe would have mentioned. But
okay, thank you very much, Sylvia, for that call. Robert in Camdenton, Missouri, you are on with Professor Steve Weidenkopf. What's your question?
Professor Weidenkopf, I was just wondering, was there ever in history a heretic that promoted the thought that Jesus Christ was only a revelation?
Robert, thanks for your question. I guess meaning like Jesus was just kind of not really truly God, truly man kind of thing, that he was just a spirit or something, or a vision? Is that what you're referring to?
It sounds like a fiction question. But I mean it more than that. The question is, if he was just a revelation, then the church, as his physical presence, was not a growing, living organism, but ironically, and false, very big false, a nothing more than divine entertainment.
So I would say, yeah, so the word revelation meaning like just a vision, I think that's what
I think I was trying to get at. So.
Okay, Robert, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, there have been all kinds of different Christological heresies, you know, Robert, in terms of, you know, who Jesus actually is. That was a big question in the early church's history as well, as the church moved into the third, into the fourth century. You know, is Jesus true God and true man? How do you explain his relationship to the God the Father, God the Holy Spirit? And there have been some, you know, who believed he was this kind of like, you know, they denied his divinity or denied his humanity and that he wasn't actually present physically, but was just kind of some, you know, supernatural vision kind of thing, or people, you know, almost kind of imagined who Jesus was or saw him, that kind of thing. So, yes.
People have taken almost every approach to try to explain really what is unexplainable. I mean, we can have some understanding, but we can't fully explain what it means for God to become a man.
Right. Yeah. It's a
mystery. Except we can say he's fully God and he's fully man.
Exactly right.
And do your best with that.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back after this with more Open Forum on Church History with Professor Steve Weidenkopf when we come back right after this.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
We've all heard the words at the end of Mass.
Go forth and announce the gospel of the Lord.
But how exactly are you to do that? In his new book, The Old Evangelization, How to Spread the Faith Like Jesus Did, apologist Eric Sammons takes you back to the source, taking a look at what Jesus did when he preached the good news and drawing out the lessons he taught us. All evangelization begins with a personal encounter, and so Sammons examines Jesus' most instructive gospel encounters and discovers within each a particular truth that even 2,000 years later can help us make new disciples. Evangelization is not an option, but Christ's express command. What better way to answer this call than by imitating his supreme example? Order your copy of The Old Evangelization today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Martin Luther and John Calvin, considered by many to be the fathers of the Protestant Reformation. But was it a reformation or a revolution? It's time you heard the real story. Catholic historian Steve Weidenkopf says that much of what we know about this crucial period in the history of the Church is seen through a Protestant lens, and that the men credited with reform of the Church actually started a revolution that sought to destroy it. History comes alive as Professor Weidenkopf takes an in-depth look at the period in history when this major change in the Church took place, and equally important, the men who sought to change it. Learn the real story. Get your copy of The Real Story of the Reformation today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Also available as an MP3.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum on the history of the Church with the man who knows, Professor Steve Weidenkopf, professor at Christendom College Graduate School on church history. And so we go now to Michael in Phoenix, Arizona. You are on with Steve Weidenkopf. What's your question, Michael?
Thanks very much for taking my call. I had a question for Steve. There was a caller that called in, it was a few callers ago, asking about Vatican II. And you had cited, I think, then-Cardinal Ratzinger writing about the reasons for Vatican II and citing World War I and World War II, and that there were a lot of people kind of falling away from the faith. And, you know, Vatican II was, at least in part, called to bring people back to the faith. I think you know, I was just making the point, I wanted to get Steve's opinion on this, that I think it's important to note that by every measure since Vatican II, you know, every measure of the strength and numbers in the church has gone down since Vatican II, and also that the Pope that presided over Vatican II, Pope John Paul VI, said that we were afraid, he was afraid that the smoke of Satan was let into the church.
Okay. Steve.
And so I think it's important to, you know, to note those things about Vatican II as well.
Okay, let's get Steve Weidenkopf's response.
Yeah, great question. So in terms of – so just I want to comment briefly on the thing you, question you made, or the comment you made rather, about you know, everything, kind of all the indicators pointing that things have, you know, gone downwards, I guess, since Vatican II. And just I want us to focus a little bit on looking at the history of councils and when councils are implemented, the teachings of councils, right? It usually, if you look back in the history of the church and the history of ecumenical councils, it usually takes a generation or so, frankly, for the teachings of a council to become really kind of permanent and enfleshed in the life of the church. And really those decrees of these councils are implemented through the activity of usually a very good pope, right, who makes it the point of his pontificate to implement these decrees. And so, you know, Paul VI tried to implement the Second Vatican Council, and in many ways, frankly, he was stymied, but only in a part of the church. And that's my larger point I want to make to you, is that when you look at the church, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, that there was a great difficulty in implementing the decree councils in the Western world, in Western Europe, in the United States, in those areas. There were people who hijacked the council, frankly, for their own personal agenda. They wanted to see changes in the church's teachings on homosexuality, for example. They wanted to see changes in other areas of the church's teachings or her life. And so they took the council and used it inappropriately to further their own private agenda. But that's only one part of the church. If you look in other parts of the church, in terms of Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe in particular, in Poland, you see, and in Africa, you see the church implementing the decrees of the council very faithfully, very strongly by the local bishops and things in those areas, and the faith flourished in those parts of the world. So we tend to always, you know, in an English-speaking world, and it's not an uncommon thing, right? We tend to kind of focus on our own world and own aspect of things and think that you know, that's applicable elsewhere. And it really wasn't. There is a distinction of the implementation between those two areas of the church. And what John Paul II did, and what Benedict XVI has done, and what Pope Francis is trying to do as well, is to further that implementation of the authentic interpretation of the council in the Western world. And I think we've seen some fruits and flowering of that recently.
Thank you very much for that call, Michael. Do you think the fact that it was those areas that were most steeped in kind of the media revolution and television and all that, that's related to their reception of the council?
Yes, I think so. I mean, you had, you know, definitely it was obviously the first ecumenical council that was covered, you know, by credentialed media members. And there was definitely a lot of you know, reporting and things that came out of that would shape people's mind, right? People don't necessarily, you know how the proceedings of the councils are supposed to go, or you know, the debating and that's applicable and that's appropriate for the councils, and have been that way, you know, from the very first beginnings of the first ecumenical council in the fourth century. But yeah, people see that and they have access to it, as you point out, in the Western world. So that becomes something that shapes their view and impression of the council.
888-318-7884 is the number. We go now to Tony in Corona, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Tony, you are on with Professor Steve Weidenkopf.
Yes, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
I'm calling, I teach fourth grade at St. Edward's School in Corona, and I'm calling because one of my students, we were talking about the Reformation, and I thought this would be a great time to call and talk to Dr. Weisskopf about maybe the five high points of Martin Luther's objection to what was going on in the church at the time.
Sure. Yeah. So, Tony, thanks so much for the call and the question, and thank you for teaching catechism to you know, in your parish. There, it's a very important work and necessary work. So, thank you for that. You know, there are many problems that Martin Luther actually had with the church during his time. I mean, the biggest problem, probably, and the one that we should focus on, and what he really got himself into trouble for, was he called into question the authority of the Pope, really. And what I mean by that is that everyone kind of associates the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation or Revolution with indulgences, right, and the so-called selling of indulgences. And obviously there was some abuse and issues with many of the indulgence preachers at the time and how they portrayed the church's teachings about indulgences. But and Luther nailed his 95 Theses, you know, allegedly on the church door of Wittenberg in October 1517. And so people always assume that that's the issue. And really that wasn't the issue. If you read through the 95 Theses, the issue that Luther had was he called into question whether the Pope had the authority to even grant an indulgence.
Mm-hmm.
And so – and then he went even further and called into question, you know, does Matthew 16 actually prove, so to speak, from Scripture that Jesus gave these keys, you know, to Peter himself and to Peter's successors, the popes. And so that's really what got him into trouble. And as he furthers his writings and he gets into 1520 when he writes three very specific treatises that kind of form the bedrock and foundation of his teaching, that's his central argument, is questioning the authority of the Pope. To the point where he even gets to the point where he thinks of the Pope as the Antichrist, that the Pope is what's completely wrong with the church. And so that's why I like to refer to the Protestant, you know, Reformation not as a reform but as a revolution, because that's what he did. He decided to not seek the reform of the church and bring it back to its pristine state, but rather to destroy it, to get rid of it and replace something else. So he took the authority of the papacy and the authority of the teaching of the church in terms of its magisterium away from the church and put it into the hands of individual believers and put the authoritative source of God's divine revelation in the Scriptures, in the Scriptures alone. And that was his significant beef.
Tony, does that help you?
Yes. Yes, it does. Thank you very much. I'm also going to purchase Dr. Weisskopf's book about the revolution.
Excellent.
Thank you very much,
Tony.
Hey, 30% off at Catholic.com all weekend. Go ahead and get there. That was his beef. Is that a normal academic kind of talk? Is that how you all talk about?
We talk about, what's your historical beef?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's his okay. main problem?
That's
yeah.
good. You guys are a bunch of thugs in academia. how about we go to Facebook for a question? Folks watch us on Facebook Live, YouTube Live, and Periscope. And sometimes they call us and sometimes they just write it in there. So Brandon on Facebook says the office of the priest is not present in Ignatius's letters. You referred to St. Ignatius
yes.
of Antioch's letters
right.
and telling us about the early life of the church. And he says, well, the office of the priest isn't mentioned there. And so how do you respond to that?
You know, I'm fairly certain, if I remember my Ignatius correctly, that he talks about the presbyterate, which is, you know, the understanding of the priesthood in those letters. So he definitely mentions, you know, the bishop, but the presbyterate is also mentioned in his letters as well to show that you know, the presbyterate were those members still today, right, priests who share in the ministry of the bishop. And the early church, you know, had those helpers of bishops just as we do today in the Catholic Church. So
if you see that word presbyter.
Yes, presbyter.
That's the same. That's the same as what we say priest nowadays in English. Another question from Facebook Live. Kelly asks, why do Protestants consider some of our early church fathers, for example, Saint Augustine, to be Protestant and not Catholic?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, historically speaking, right? Technically, you cannot say that any of the early church fathers were Protestants simply because they all lived before the 16th century when the Protestant so-called reform began, right? So technically, historically, you want to focus on that. But what ends up happening is many Protestant, theologians and teachers and whatnot, you have to the very nature of the word Protestant means you're protesting something, right? And that word actually comes from the Diet of Speyer in 1529, when a series of German delegates to the Diet refused to allow the Mass to be celebrated in their territories, contrary to the decree of the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V. And so what they did was they protested this decree of Charles V. So they protested the celebration of the Mass. That's where the whole word Protestant actually comes from. So, which is a little bit of a tangent, but what Protestants are trying to do when they utilize like Augustine or Origen or Tertullian or any of these other early church fathers and say, oh, they're Protestant, they're really interpreting and reading backwards into them, right? They have their Protestant teaching, their Protestant doctrine they're trying to show as true. And so they go back and read back into those church fathers and try to point out and say, well, Augustine believes just like we did, because it's a way to justify the faith. But at the end of the day, you have to take solace in what Cardinal Newman said, that to know history is to cease to be Protestant. If you really knew the history of the church, if you really knew what the church fathers wrote, they in no way, shape, or form are Protestant.
And that is exactly what happened to Cardinal Newman.
Exactly.
He became a Catholic, and then he became a Catholic cardinal.
Exactly.
John, in Costa Mesa, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio, what's your question for Steve Weidenkopf?
I think you might have partially answered what I was thinking, but in regards to, you know, Protestants going back and looking, you know, reading history through their lens. But my question is, you know, as Catholics, we do use history to prove our point, right, that the church is the Catholic Church is the church Jesus Christ started and all their teachings. But yet, you know, Orthodox, Protestants, what have you, they all also use their view of history to prove their case. And I always thought history was not subjective, but apparently it is. And so I guess that's where my frustration is. How does everyone supposedly look at the same history yet come up with different conclusions?
Yeah, that's a great question there, John. So how do we explain that in 30 seconds or less? Because there's a whole discussion on the history profession itself and what is history. And frankly, you know, before the 18th century, history was not seen as a science, right? History was seen as a form of literature, and that's how it was written and how it was taught and how it's understood. It wasn't until you get into the 18th, 19th century when history begins to be trying to portrayed more as this objective science that, and there's good things to that. Right, looking at the documentary references, looking at manuscripts, going back to the original sources, not relying on second and third hand sources and those kinds of things, or the quote opinions of others. So there's very very much value in the history profession of seeing the area as a science, right? Seeing the discipline as a science. But on the other hand, right, we also have to know that history is a narrative, right? It's the telling of a person's story or a people's story or the church's story, for example. And that doesn't mean that it's fake or that it's false or that it's fiction. It is it's a work of nonfiction, right? History is nonfiction. So there's certain dates that obviously, and other events and people that are not incontrovertible, right? They're not going to be challenged, right? We do know for a fact that, Luther, for example, appeared before the Diet of Worms in 1521 or whatever, right? I mean, those are undisputed facts. But what the historian does is the historian culls all that information that he's given or that he can unearth or review and read through manuscripts and try to present it in a way that's understandable to others. And a good historian, right, will tell you from the very beginning what his perspective is. Right? I wrote a book, for example, on the Crusades. My perspective on the Crusades as a faith-believing Catholic historian is going to be different than someone who's more of a secular historian. We're going to agree on the basic facts, but our interpretation of those facts might be different. And so, in terms of church history, right, there are definite, definitive, undisputed facts. But obviously a Protestant coming from a Protestant perspective is going to try to use some of those points to prove, their particular position. Whereas a Catholic historian is in a certain sense going to do the same. But I think if you just look at the history objectively, especially the history of the church, you'll know that the Catholic is really the one who, we have the original story, so to speak. We have the unadulterated version of history because the church has been Catholic until the 16th century. And then it becomes, even before that, you have the Orthodox Church, I know, but, really it's in that 16th century when you have the Protestant break. And so it's incumbent on those Protestant historians to try to justify why that break occurred. And the narrative they use is that, well, it's really like Protestantism is really like the early church when it's not.
Yeah, right. Exactly. John, thank you very much for that call. Again, next hour, Dr. Peter Kraft from Boston College will be here, prolific writer and speaker and apologist and all around, well, very important Catholic in the world today. So we're happy to finish the week with him. Professor Steven Weidenkopf, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure
here.
Sorry, thanks for having me.
It was a real pleasure learning history, the true history of the church. Somebody should write a book about the glory of the Crusades.
I did.
Oh, wait a second. He did write one of those. Sorry that you got to fly on a red eye to get home.
No, it's all right. Good to be home. Good to get back home.
It was really nice to have you here in the studio with us, too. Thank you for doing that.
My pleasure.
Steve Weidenkopf, the Glory of the Crusades is the book. You can get all of Steve Weidenkopf's materials at 30% off through the weekend at Catholic.com. Peter Kraft coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live.